Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 266. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Just send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn about all the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is, of course, This Show Is So Gay. And go to the Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have such a fun episode for you this week with two amazing guests. We must start with the first one. Leanna Creel is an actor, a producer, a director, a writer, a photographer. On the small screen, she has starred in everything from the Parent Trap franchise to the 80s classics Growing Pains and My Two Dads to her iconic contribution to the canon of Saved by the Bell as Tori Scott, the tough-as-nails newbie with a big heart under that leather jacket. Highlights from her career behind the camera include Offside, a short film she wrote and directed, which reaped in the awards everywhere from Milan to Montreal. And in 2005, she directed Promtroversy, which won the grand prize at the Planet Out Short Movie Awards. We have so much to talk about and thrilled to have her. Leanna, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You ready? We got a lot of ground to cover.
Okay, I'm ready.
All right. Well, we have to start with your family life because you fall into that extraordinarily small group, less than 1%, and I looked it up, that can stand up and say, hey, I am a triplet.
Oh, yeah. There's not very many of us. Well, even less if you say I'm an identical triplet.
Look at that.
It's actually even more rare. I have no idea what the odds are, but it's rare.
It's rare. What was that like for you? Now, I was reading all about triplets who have secret languages. Did you guys have that?
I think we might have had some words and stuff that we that we used growing up. And I was just thinking about this because, like, I sent my kid off to camp yesterday, and he just waltzed right in, and I was like, he's so confident. I'm like, I don't remember ever being that confident. I'm like, wait a minute, I never had to go anywhere by myself. Like, I don't remember ever going to any, walking into any class or camp or anything by myself, probably until I was 18. So, you know, it was a lot of fun. You know, they were always there.
I we have to just diverge for a second. How are you dealing, Mom, who just sent her son off to camp?
Well, I'm doing well. He just finished kindergarten, so
nice.
It's going by really fast. And then we have a 1-year-old that just turned one. So yeah, 1-year-old and a 6-year-old. So we're definitely in the domestic. It's very gay.
It's very gay. It's so gay, one could say. One could say that.
So gay-y. Yeah, so we're in the gay-y boom.
Now, where was that part of the whole process where someone made the decision, hey, these triplets should act together?
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so back in the day, I was 15 years old. We had a friend that did, like, Transformer commercials and stuff like that, and we were in Orange County, so we didn't know anybody in Hollywood, but our friend that did Transformers commercials, we just thought he was too cool, and he just called up and said, oh, my agent wants to meet you, and so we're like, sure, what the heck, you know, and we didn't think we looked alike. That's the kind of funny thing, because we had never tried to look alike. We didn't want to really admit that we looked alike.
Right.
And we got made ourselves, you know, we wore the same clothes and we got all dressed up and we're like, oh my gosh, I wonder if they're going to buy it. I wonder if they're going to think we look alike. And we came back from that meeting. We're like, we pulled the wool over their eyes. They actually thought we looked alike. And so very soon after that, when I actually saw pictures of us, I'm like, all right, we do look alike. I'll admit it. But we were, you know, trying to individuate so much. And so we never wore the same thing or did that, except for when we were very small, when my grandparents would give us the same outfit. But the rest of my childhood, we tried to be so different, you know, different hairstyles, different everything. And then right there from like 16, 17, 18, we all started to try to look alike again for a few years.
Oh. So,
and now we've diverged back again into our own individual selves.
And was everyone on board, or was there one of the three of you who the other two were like, all right, we got to convince her?
Well, it's interesting because there was – all three of us were into it at the beginning.
Right.
But after a certain time, I was kind of over being the triplet sight gag, and I was really ready to go on and do my own thing. And
yeah.
Monica and Joyce still wanted to do it. And I remember they wanted us to be the host of, like, Ripley's Believe It or Not or something. Like, it had these identical triplets be the host. And I remember saying I didn't want to do it, and the producer calling me and said, you'll never work in Hollywood again. Really? It was pretty clear at that point. I'm like, no, you know. So, yeah, it was great while it lasted, and I was very grateful, you know. My sisters and I were able to pair our own way through college and, for me, grad school as well. And
yeah.
So it was, I'm very, very, very grateful. It came around at the perfect time. My parents at the didn't, you know, have that much money to send all three of us away to college. And so this was a way we could do that. So I'm very, very grateful.
Well, let's talk about some of those acting highlights. Now, I do not know the importance of the role of Shannon Wilson on Perry Mason, The Case of the Fatal Fashion. But let me tell you, I don't care anything else that you did, even though I really do care about all these other things that you did. You got to be on Perry Mason, and I'm kind of a dork, and that's big.
Well, I remember I got a free trip to, I think they shot it in Colorado.
Nice.
And I remember that was, you know, but yeah, it's the whole, I can barely remember that one, but I remember I was like, in the cross-examination, I broke down.
Nice.
And admitted that I, like, broke out of the house or lied to my parents or something like that. But that's all I really remember about that.
I'm convinced, based on neither of ours' recollection, that Shannon Wilson was a pivotal role that really changed the course of that episode.
And I would never even remember that her name was Shannon Wilson. I'm so glad you've reignited my memory.
I'm here to help. I'm here to help you. So we must, of course, it's so funny because we talked for a couple seconds before we started recording just about Saved by the Bell. And I would like to put out there, as I said to you, but I'm recording it here right now, that I reached out to you before this unbelievable week of resurgence of Saved by the Bell interest.
Yes, it's really interesting. There's something in the nostalgic air about the 90s. I mean, people are suddenly very interested. I mean, I've never been contacted by TMZ ever in my entire life. So I thought I took that as a little pop culture badge of honor. But to be contacted by TMZ, it's kind of a Rubicon in this business.
So, absolutely.
So anyway, no, it was, there's just something in the air. It's just funny. And I guess obviously their Lifetime is doing a show that's behind the scenes.
Right.
Shenanigans. Of Saved by the Bell.
And you told TMZ that you think Ellen Page should play you.
Well, here's the thing. That was like the one question. And I remember they said, well, who'd you want to play you? And I said, I don't even know any of the young actors. And then like I hung up with them and then, did you say Ellen Page? Oh, I came up with Ellen Page. I was like, Ellen Page. And so I texted the guy back and I'm like, Ellen Page. It was like the only question that got out of me because he wanted to know of what I thought about Dustin Diamond's book and I hadn't read it. So I was a complete wash as an interview except for that one tidbit. But
and that's what they printed.
It'd be amazing. Yeah. So anyway.
Now, have you ever seen, because I've kind of done a nosedive right into all of these different websites. Do you know there are like all of these theories about Tori Scott and her place in the Saved by the Bell canon?
Well, I haven't really done that, but I know that there was this book written a number of years ago by Chuck Klosterman, and he had a chapter in it called The Tory Principle, and it was the principle of, like, in a TV show, when a character appears in one season, it's out of the chronology, but it's never explained, like how Tori could be in key episodes but not be in the graduation episode,
right.
Things like that. So I know that it is totally ludicrous and made no sense, and I was just brought in as like a plot device, really, on again, off again, girlfriend of the various characters on the show.
There's also this thing called the Tory reality, which apparently is a parallel universe.
Oh, I'm going to have to look that up. I didn't even know about the Tory reality. But you know that there's actually an off-Broadway musical called Bayside the Musical.
Nice.
And I'm actually going to go see that in New York and probably be horrified. But my character, I have been warned, is played by the same character that plays Mr. Belding.
Oh,
so yeah,
gosh.
A man in drag plays Tori. So I'm going to go embraced. To be humiliated.
That's fantastic. Well, before we leave Saved by the Bell behind, we will ask you the question. You can definitively tell us here. Are you upset that you didn't get to graduate?
Yeah, I mean, that is, you know, it's, I don't know how to answer those kind of questions. Somebody asked me on like a podcast recently, which was better, the Max or the Peach, because I whatever, Peach Pit or whatever it was on 90210.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, I don't even know how to answer that question. I'm sorry. You know they weren't real, right? You know, it's like, it's just make pretend. But yeah, it's just funny to have this weird thing that took place in my life. Actually, I was in college, and
right.
It was a long time ago. And then just to bring up all these memories, and I'm like, well, I haven't even thought about this in a long time. So it is kind of fun after all this time. I actually, again, before this resurgence a couple weeks ago, I pulled out a Saved by the Bell episode and played it for my 5-year-old, he just turned 6, almost 6-year-old, and he thought it was hilarious. He loved Screech. He was giggling, laughing, and it's like, "Mommy, you're on TV." So I got a kick out of that. But he's been asking to watch more, and I'm like, "No, there's no more. That's enough."
It was just one. It was a one shot.
Exactly.
Now, I will tell you, and I don't want to scare you, but in high school, they did show us the drinking and driving episode as a cautionary tale.
Oh, yeah. He wasn't that crazy. I mean, really, really, you know, nuanced writing. That Tori, the bad girl, the one that doesn't drink.
She, exactly.
And I was drinking orange soda. So, yeah, that was, I mean, that's deep. That was really, really nuanced. So, yeah. I feel like every episode was sort of a, you know, kind of a glorified morality tale.
Oh, yeah.
Sort. It was either teen driving or wheelchair basketball.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's like everything. I can't remember even the other ones.
These earthquake were not safety. Thinly veiled earthquake
yeah.
safety.
Yeah, it was very, very, yeah. Yeah, earthquake safety, practically turning to the camera and saying, a real earthquake kit would probably have a blah, blah, blah. Yeah, it was. So, yeah, I wasn't even aware that they had always been like that, or if it was just like the 10 that I did because it was the end of the run and the producers were feeling like they had a social responsibility or something. Were they all like that, all the previous episodes too, or just the 10 that I was in? I don't even know.
I think that you were the morality plot device.
So they were like, wait a minute, we should try to do some good. We've made a million of these.
What if she didn't drink? That's, yeah. That happened in a room somewhere.
Yeah.
That well, question
my favorite was, this might be part of the toy reality, was that when I delivered Mrs. Belding's baby in an elevator, in the first and only time Bayside had an elevator, so that was particularly great. I mean, I literally delivered the baby in the elevator, so that was pretty, you know, really like art imitates life, I'm sure.
I'm sure, and can I tell you how gay I am in this moment that I am now having a flashback? This is so pathetic. Gay and 90s, I am now having the flashback to remembering pretty certainly that you needed Slater's shirt in order to put the baby into, and thus it was a shirtless Slater scene.
And, you know, and basically any time Mario could turn that into a shirtless scene, I'm sure he was happy to do so.
That's hilarious.
He worked hard for that physique.
Oh, there
so,
you go.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Tell everyone, what prompted you to move behind the camera?
Well, I'm actually, when I was a kid, when I was from the time I was probably third grade, fourth grade, I wanted to make movies, I wanted to be a photographer, I wanted to be behind the camera, and it was only because of the weird quirk of fate that I was an identical triplet, which is kind of how I ended up in front of the camera. But, you know, even when I was in front of the camera, I was asking a lot of questions about the cameras and the production. I was very interested in that. I even remember we did this show called Parent Trap, and mm-hmm. we did a Parent Trap Hawaiian honeymoon. And I remember the camera crew gave me a shirt, and it was like me on a surfboard with like a camera, because I was like asking. I guess I was asking a lot of questions about the cameras. So it was really my passion was always been behind the camera. And not super. I can't sing. I can't dance. I'm not really in front of the camera kind of person. It was shameless money making, and very grateful for it. But I'm much, much more comfortable behind the camera, and I feel like that is my true calling. So.
Well, let's talk about some of your work behind the camera. I watched earlier this week. I watched Offside, and for folks who have not seen it, it's a true story about the Christmas Truce of 1914, when British and German soldiers on the Western Front, they actually put down their guns and they played a bit of soccer. Before we even talk about my reaction to it, which I had a pretty strong one, what drew you to that material?
Well, I was interested in telling. I mean, I love the story, and I'm a bleeding heart liberal. I believe in peace and all that crap. No, but I you know, my wife is British, and she told me that story. And when we made the film, I wasn't even sure if it was true. I was pretty sure it was true. Now there's been, like, books written about it and stuff in the last 10 years. But, you know, it was just a great story, a very hopeful story, and also one that I could tell visually. I mean, in the original script, I didn't write any dialogue. It was all going to be done with no dialogue, and I really like that idea of telling a story completely visually, because that's the kind of filmmaker that I am.
Yeah.
I don't really like talky films and chit-chatty things. You know, I'm more of like a visual person, and so I try, you know, and then basically the dialogue that's in there is just what we improvised and came up with just before or during the shoot. So, and interesting enough, I didn't do this intentionally, but because of that, it played really well internationally. I mean, it played everywhere around the world, South Africa and Japan, and I mean, everywhere in the world, and so that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that at the time. I was just trying to dialogue just wasn't my thing. I'm more of a visual storyteller.
Well, it's about 9 minutes long, and folks can watch it on YouTube. I don't know if they're not supposed to do that, and there's a royalty thing. I have no idea. But you can watch it on YouTube. I did. It messed me up a little bit, I will tell you. I think because we're at this kind of interesting confluence of the World Cup and there being violence in the world, and I just kind of watched it and thought, what the hell? Like, this happened. This can happen. These were actual people and, you know, kind of pawns on a chessboard kind of thing who are actual humans who saw that humanity in that moment. Why isn't everyone playing soccer instead of warring? And I know that's really basic, but that's where I was. And I actually, I'll be very upfront with you, I got quite choked up over it.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that it had an effect.
Oh, yeah.
I think the same thing, too. I'm like, maybe we could just play a soccer game.
Right.
Just work it out, guys. Come on. So, yeah.
So I was like, yes, let's everyone play soccer. You know, it was just, it really, folks, please go check it out because it's one of those, at the same time, it gives you a ton of hope. And then you're also like so frustrated of, why isn't this happening more? This actually happened.
Yeah. It's an inspiring story, and it didn't. And as it turns out, there were spontaneous sort of truces along the Western Front. It wasn't just this one place. You know, sometimes they just came out and they swapped like belt buckles and chocolate and this and that. You know, but it was, it wasn't just like one isolated incident. It actually happened a number of places along the Western Front, and then literally the next day there was orders that came down. It was like shoot, they either pulled them away from the front if they refused to shoot, or they got in trouble. Or they had to just start shooting again. So yeah, it was. And also, there's a poignancy about World War One. Like everybody thought, like with every war, it'll be so easy. We're just going to go in. It'll be like, you know, no problem. And we'll be home by Christmas was sort of the thing. And so there was something extra poignant about being Christmas, the first Christmas. Everybody was supposed to be home by then, and they weren't. They were dug in these trenches in these crappy conditions, you know. So anyway,
So good.
It's
so good. And by the way, random ephemera. I thought, did I just see that wrong? But no, indeed, I went back and looked. Executive producer, one of them, Michael Bolton.
Yes, a little shout out for Michael Bolton because he read the script. I had a friend that was doing some work with him, and I was just decided I was going to make this movie. I didn't know how I was going to come up with the money, but I was going to make this short film. And he read the script and said, "I believe in it, and I believe in you. And how much do you need?" And literally, I was like, oh, no, is he going to want to be in it? Is he going to want to be a world soldier? He's like, no, I want you to have complete creative control. And he literally had no notes. He let me make exactly the film I wanted to make, was completely supportive. And I was like, do you need me to sell this film to one of these places? And he's like, I don't need, you know, just do what you need to do, whatever's best for you. I just want to. So it was such an awesome experience to be so supported and he was such a great guy, and he really was awesome to
That's
me as a
so
maybe
great.
An artist to another artist. It was a really wonderful gift. So
I love that. I saw it and I thought, wait, there's another Michael. No, it's really Michael Bolton.
Yeah, it was. I know it's so strange, but the Lord works in mysterious ways.
That is true. So, and then you were a producer on the Gay Classic, and we're talking Gay Classic, but I'm a cheerleader. People, yeah. The gays go nuts over that movie.
You know, it's interesting because not when it first came out.
No.
When it first came out, I think we got like a D or maybe even an F at Entertainment Weekly, and especially the men thought we weren't taking it seriously enough because it was really painful at that moment in time at these ex-gay movements, and Exodus was in full swing, and you know, people were just really, well, they didn't get it. Like we did on purpose, the production design was meant to look like if you leaned over, the set would fall down. Like, yeah, we didn't have very much money, but that was actually a stylistic choice.
Right.
It was meant to look like, you know, not real and like artifice. And so people didn't really get it. It's amazing, you know, that success changes, you know, rewrites history a little bit because, at the time, people didn't really get it, the men. We were trying to make a movie like, you know, that was fun and for teenagers, for young people, because it seemed like at that time, especially for lesbians, there was just like poetry reading, you know.
Right.
Again, we've already established I hate. But I really love The Incredible Two Adventures of Two Girls in Love.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to add to that canon, something that's fun and it's not all hand-wringing, I'm coming out, but something that was just funny and fun. And Jamie Babbitt and Andrea Sterling brought me a treatment for this. And I mean, I fell in love with it instantly and related to it a little bit. And so it was really, really one of the films that I'm the most proud of being a part of.
So, oh, I love it. I love it. Well, let's shift to you and your personal life, because in 2008, California said, yeah, we'll start approving some marriages. And you guys were right there, were you not?
Yes, we were, 2 days later. Yeah, it was just, we actually just went down there to check it out, like in West Hollywood, like, let's just go see what's happening down at the park. And we got caught up in everything, and we're like, maybe we should just get a license. And Renat was, like, very, very pregnant with our first child. And people were like, oh, what do you do? And we said, Thursday. And they were like, come right this way. So we got, like, ushered to the front of the line. And so we called a friend who was, like, a Presbyterian minister. And we called up our friends. And we literally, you know, had a ceremony and got married. And 2 days later, our first son was born. So, which was kind of neat, you know, because I was, like, legally married when he was born. So I feel like it just added another layer of legal protection.
I'm sure that your wife loves the part where you are forever quoted in the news, and I will quote, we're having a shotgun wedding. We don't have any time to wait. She could give birth at any moment.
Is that what I said? Oh,
yeah.
God. But it was like very festive. I don't know if you had a chance to go down and check it out in West Hollywood, where they were, I mean, it was a party. People were bringing back cupcakes and cakes and dressing up. And
I love it.
It was like one big, like, community party, and it was just such a moment, like, people thought it would never happen. And then it got put on pause, and then, interestingly enough, within a couple weeks of our second son being born, DOMA was knocked down. It was, like, so crazy. I'm like,
is it you two? Yeah. Is that the link?
I think our family is, like, our history is, like, can be pegged to major moments in gay rights movement.
There is a Tory parallel universe.
Exactly.
That's what it is. That's what it is. There is also, I have to tell you, it's so brilliant. There's an amazing piece online, and everybody should go check it out. It's called An Unconventional Marriage, A Judeo-Christian I Do. And it's a piece that details your and your wife's, the interfaith aspect of your marriage. Mm-hmm. And in that piece, this is what you said in that piece. Quote, I think the interfaith thing was trumped by the gay thing, so our parents had already been through that shock, but I knew they would love her, and they have noticed I'm a nicer, better person when I'm with her. My dad is a little worried about me and has reminded me that I don't have to give up who I am and what I believe in. My parents got a divorce the year after we got married, and now both of my parents are dating Jews, so who knows, maybe we inspired them.
I mean, you can't write this stuff, right? You couldn't invent this. You could not invent this.
Tell everyone, because I love this aspect of the story, and it just entertains me immensely. Tell everyone, were they to have walked into your bedroom at that time, what would they have encountered above your bed?
Oh, did I talk about that too?
Oh, yeah.
Well, when I first met Renat, yeah, when she first came over to my place, I had a collection of crosses from all around. I spent a lot of time in Latin America in college and had been collecting these crosses, and she had a panic. This is where she comes from, pretty Orthodox. They considered Orthodox Judaism, where she grew up, where the men and women sit separately. And so even though, like, hers was Jewish and mine was a Christian upbringing, we were both raised in very strict sort of communities. I was raised in a very rigid evangelical / fundamentalist background.
Okay.
So it's very strange, again, to find this. There's actually, we actually had a lot of likes, similarities, just being raised in those kind of bubbles.
I will tell you, that first line of the interfaith thing was trumped by the gay thing. It's interesting because I feel like I've had both experiences, just being a gay Jew, and sometimes I feel like, you know, it's in some ways more important to my parents that I find someone who's Jewish rather than I find someone of the opposite sex. And it's just this constant kind of dance back and forth.
Yeah, it's weird. My granny, who sadly just passed away a month or so ago, I remember her sitting me down, and it was like our first big talk about it. I was very close with her growing up. And our first big talk, and I'm like, oh, no, here it comes. It was not about the lesbian thing. It was the fact that Renat, in her mind, was not going to heaven because she hadn't accepted Jesus as her personal savior. And that really bothered her to literally on her deathbed, was still bothering her. And I just kept telling Granny, I promise I'll see. She was worried about my salvation too. So I was like, Granny, I promise I'll see you there. You know, I just wanted her to not go out being sad,
right,
and believing that I wasn't going to be there. And she just made me swear that I would tell my kids about Jesus. And I said, I absolutely would tell them about the first century Palestinian Jewish rabbi, Jesus.
He will come up in a conversation.
Jesus. Yes. I want to talk about the historical Jesus of Nazareth. Yeah.
No, it's a real, it's one of those topics that we don't talk about nearly enough. Of it's okay, we're good with the gay thing. Yeah, but the interfaith thing is very much a real issue in our community.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like there's been some progress there, too. It feels like there's been some groups, I've noticed some parenting groups, interfaith, gay and lesbian pairing groups, and so maybe this is the next frontier.
Well, whenever your family has some sort of life event, that's what I've learned, is that's when the community changes.
Exactly. I'll let you know when we're expecting our third child.
I don't even know what we're going to get approved next. Ohio is going to get same-sex marriage. You guys kind of got to get on it.
Oh, my goodness.
That's a lot of pressure.
It definitely happened pretty fast.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, I remember, you know, because Promtroversy, the short film that I made,
yes,
actually we made that right when Renette and I were getting our first wedding, which wasn't quote-unquote legal, in 2004. You know, it was a parody of DOMA, and I remember thinking, I wonder when this is ever going to get knocked down, if ever. I had no idea. I mean, how long, you know, and so in some ways it took longer than I thought, and then when I look back, I'm like, wow, we've come quite far in a short amount of time.
We really have. We really have.
Yeah.
Well, what are you working on that we should all know about?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I just finished a documentary, an immigration-themed documentary, and I
nice.
Must say, in the kind of frustrations with where we are with immigration reform right now, I'm actually encouraged by what's happened with the gay movement, because there were times where it was just not long ago. Everybody was demoralized, and DOMA passed, and, you know, Prop 8 passed, and everybody was really down in the dumps, like, this is never going to change, what's going on? And so, anyways, I've been pretty involved with the immigration reform movement, so I've just finished a film called Anchor Baby. It's a very small, kind of an intimate film about a mother and a daughter who are threatened to be separated by deportation, and they move into their church in downtown Los Angeles. And so anyway, it's kind of showing it in a lot of grassroots places, anybody that will show it. We just want people to talk about immigration reform and not let it slip off the agenda.
Oh, yeah.
Again. So just finished that. I'm not sure what my next documentary project will be, or if it'll be a narrative film or a documentary. I'm kind of on the lookout. But in the meantime, I have a production company where we focus on food and travel lifestyle, photography, videography, imagery. So we work with a lot. I just got back from Napa working on doing some imagery for a new ultra-premium wine brand.
And awesome.
I'm also, you know, again, the bleeding heart part of me. I also do a fair amount of nonprofit videos for nonprofits that I believe in. And so I definitely keep busy, but I'm basically doing what I wanted to do when I was 9 years old, which was take pictures and make movies and be involved with projects that are meaningful. And so, you know, I'm very grateful.
You're doing it. You're doing it.
Yeah.
And just hearing about that, I have to tell you, it's just so unbelievably inspiring. And you've had such an incredible and varied career and so many more projects yet to come. And of course, you know, we love all of your on-screen work, but I have to tell you, Offside is going to stick with me for quite some time. And then I'm really urging people to just go to YouTube and go watch it, because it's one of those that, yes, it was made a few years ago. It is relevant every single day. And you so well capture kind of that spirit of hope and everything that we need to do to change. And that runs through so many of your projects. So my hope is that in addition to having another child and changing the course of gay history, that you just keep making these projects, because your voice really does make a difference, Liana.
Oh, well, thank you. That's so kind of you to say. I really appreciate it.
So I wish you all the best in New York. I think that production is going to be hilarious, and you need to tell us all about it.
I will. I will. I think it sounds like a lot of fun. So
thank you for everything that you're doing.
Well, thank you, and again, good luck with the show.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, let me pull back the curtain a little bit on the inner workings of This Show Is So Gay. When I am in a bind, which happens with some frequency, and there's a last-minute opening on the show because a guest bailed or perhaps the power went out, as it did last week, and then I start thinking to myself, hey, This Show Is So Gay is a lot of work. All I really want to do right this second is just welcome a guest I could just kick back with and gab about all things gay and pop culture. Well, for me, that's a pretty short list, and right there at the top of that list is this week's extraordinarily accommodating guest, very flexible, very entertaining. His name, Phil Putnam. He is one of my favorite singer-songwriters out there. He bends piano-based pop rock around smart and stunning lyrics over the course of his many, many albums out there, his two number one hit videos and MTV logo, and every performance he puts back out there to that world. Now he is back here with us. We're going to be debuting a song of his. Phil Putnam, welcome back to This Show Is So Gay.
Hello. Thank you so much for putting me at the top of your list.
I love having you on top. And let me tell you something. See, this is where it goes. This is where it goes.
Right away.
I could say it's been 2 years since we've talked, but it's almost like we just talked last week. That's what it feels like to me.
It really feels like that because we actually did.
We did talk last week. We tried to do this last week, and then Cleveland said, no, we're going to cut your power, gay people. And then I moved into a house, so I should tell everyone, Phil Putnam, the first ever guest in my new house.
Oh, I'm so glad to christen it with you.
Yes, well, we'll wipe it down after. We have so much, that's the mood I'm in. Good luck, audience. So much to talk about, Phil. So, this is the way I have approached this week. Sometimes I do research on the guests. Sometimes I want to ask them about all their life events. Instead, I just went to your Facebook page and I picked 8 or 9 topics that I would like to talk about with you from your Facebook page that are kind of gay and definitely pop culture. Are you ready?
Bring it.
Okay. Let's start with, what are the odds? We're starting with a mathematical question, so yes, I know. You need to answer in percentages. What are the odds that Bette Midler will win an Oscar?
Oh my God. Okay. So clearly I've thought about this. I have. And not because anybody's ever asked me. I've just thought about this. I will say this, her greatest chances of winning an Oscar would be for Best Original Song, probably as a lyricist or a co-writer.
Okay.
So I think it's completely possible. And I will say, that's the only thing that's missing in her EGOT, by the way.
For folks who don't know, because we might have some people listening, they're like, what is an EGOT, some sort of bird? No, folks, that's an EGRET. What is an EGOT?
An EGOT is somebody who's won an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony.
Gotcha.
There are, I think, only 12 people for the musically theater inclined out there. The most recent EGOT recipient or achiever was Robert Lopez.
Yes.
Who wrote the song Let It Go from Frozen that won the Oscar this past year.
I have never heard that song.
No, it's so new, but you know, you may recall quite a solemn performance by Idina Menzel at the Oscars,
and yes,
sort of adjacent to that whole experience. So yeah, I think that, and by the way, I will say this, as a proud songwriter of those EGOT winners, almost all of them were songwriters.
Yeah. All right, so she's got a shot. She could write a song.
Think about that world.
I thought she was going to win one for the Boys. I loved that song.
I thought she was going to win one for Jinx, but it's right there in the title.
Yeah.
You know, I will say, I think Bette can do anything. The chances of her getting an Oscar-winning acting role in the remainder of her career, I think, are probably slightly lower than her winning an Oscar related to music.
Okay. All right, so we're going to keep our eyes on that. That is topic number one. Topic number two, I understand that you recently saw, which I have not seen it yet, Maleficent. How gay and enjoyable was it?
Oh my God, Kate. It's like if there ever was a movie that was made just for the sole purpose of showcasing capes, it was this movie. It was amazing. It was high drag. It was like Dynasty on Ecstasy times 2014. The costuming was incredible. I mean, visually, it was almost too much, but it was such a stunning film. If you ever want to see Angelina Jolie just having the time of her life, which if you're not sure what that looks like, it looks like, well, it just looks like somebody standing there looking really angry.
Nice.
But she's a solemn gal. She's a sad gal.
Oh, yeah.
But it's just, there's so many things about it that are amazing. However, of the things that are not amazing, it includes the script and the story and the pacing. And so if you're going in, like, really wanting, like, this amazing theatrical story experience, or you're totally a Sleeping Beauty fanatic, you're going to walk away angry and, like, torching villages.
But if you're going to go see Capes...
Oh, my God. Go for Capes, and I swear to God, there is a python turban that will blow your mind.
How many times a day do you say that? I've never used the phrase python turban. I feel it should be worked into a conversation more.
Six, at least.
Six, okay. Okay.
Daily.
And before we leave this topic behind, because I'm sure our listening audience would want to know, are you indeed wearing a cape right now?
When am I not wearing any cape? And you can just imagine, that collar is dramatic. I'm spinning.
Oh, right now. All right.
Do you feel it? I'm spinning.
I'm wearing an emotional cape, but we're going to move on to the next topic. Now, another topic that we have to discuss, you recently went on a bit of a binge, and it's very exciting. Tell everyone about your affection for the address called Melrose Place.
Oh, my God. Okay, so my partner is a crazy fan. And by the way, we're not talking about that lame-ass attempt at the CW reboot happening in, like, late 2000s. We're talking about, like, the OG original Melrose Place.
Yes.
So it's on Netflix Watch instantly, right? And so my partner, Vince, who I love, happy anniversary, almost 6 years.
Yay!
Which is, like, gay forever. So we're going back and we're watching Melrose Place on Netflix. It's candy and it's good summer fun.
Yeah.
And I don't know if people realize this. This is what I find most astounding about Melrose Place. And I'm not exaggerating here, and I am prone to hyperbole. There are like 35 episodes in each season, and like seasons 2 through 4 and maybe beyond. I haven't had the courage to venture farther than season 4 right now. Like 35 or 36 episodes.
That's a lot.
That's a long season.
Yes.
I think maybe what they did is they, because 90210 became a hit because they did the summer season.
Right.
And that's what they found their following. So I'm guessing that Melrose Place did the same thing. And that's why there's like 900 hours of this show.
Is there a character with whom you most identify?
Brooke, of course. Kristen Davis's character, of course.
Really?
Yeah. It's mostly the shiny brown hair.
Okay.
I mean, my hair used to be that color. I've been gray since I was 17, so I'm mostly going far down memory lane.
Didn't she die in the pool?
I think she did die in the pool, although okay. I haven't gotten that far yet.
Oh, sorry.
I mean, you're not breaking my heart, please. Nobody needs a good end on that show, so I'm not surprised.
I identify most with Jane.
Oh, my God. That's, like, the worst one you could pick.
I know.
Oh, God.
I swear she had a career. But, yeah, no, it's Jane. Jane is my heart.
Okay. Do you have the same wardrobe as Jane?
Okay. Wearing a midriff right now. Moving on. You have an unnatural, I just labeled it unnatural. I meant to say intimate. What is your relationship with ice cream?
Oh, God. Oh, God. There's some in me right now. It is insane the lengths I will go to eat ice cream.
And indeed, let me connect this to a gay story. You found yourself eating ice cream during Pride right there in Chelsea.
Oh my God, I did. And it wasn't even like, I'm going to go down and have a moment. And it wasn't like, you know, when you do things for the sole purpose of having a Facebook status?
Yeah.
This is a safe space. Everybody's done it. We can all admit it. This was not one of those moments. I was just bored and alone on Pride Saturday night. And I'd wanted to go to Big Gay Ice Cream Shop, which is an actual ice cream shop in the West Village,
yes,
in New York. It's right on the corner of Queer. So I went down there and braved the line, and I had what's called a salty pimp, which is delicious. And then I went to the ice cream shop. Kidding. Anyway, so I get my ice cream.
I will add sound effects in later for that one.
Thank you. Add
no problem.
Shot.
Yes.
So I get my ice cream, and then I'm standing there on the corner, and it's the middle of Gay Pride in, like, the gay epicenter of New York, which some will tell you is Chelsea, but that ain't true. That's not true. It's the West Village right near Stonewall. So I'm just standing there, and it's like 10:30, and there are swarms of people around me, and I'm just eating my ice cream cone. I know this is, you know, there are so many puns that can be made about this. There you go.
We'll let our audience make those, yes.
Exactly.
All right. How was Pride other than that, other than your Chelsea ice cream experience?
You know, it was great. It was loud. It's always loud.
Yeah.
And I live very near the parade route, and let me tell you, that parade is long, and it's loud, and God bless it. I love it.
Okay.
You know, and it's such an interesting Pride in New York, because it genuinely is an international experience. And I've never seen it before, where it was Pride and World Cup at the same time.
I don't even know what that looks like.
And I don't even know if maybe you're not realizing this, but apparently America cares about soccer. It's suddenly a thing. Do we think it'll last? I'm not so sure on that one. Anyway, so it's like all of like the soccer hooliganism combined with the Pride hooliganism. It was basically resulted in a lot of shorts, which I'm fine with.
Yeah. Now, I will be honest with you. I lived in New York City for, 8-9 years. I never once went to New York City Pride.
You know, it's Pride. This is my thing about Pride. It's not everybody's cup of tea.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially, and I'm not somebody who really is like a typical scene gay at all. I'm much more the guy that's like coffee and conversation. That's a rockin' Saturday night for me. But I'm less inclined to like go to a bar by myself or, you know, go to a club and dance or something. And that's just my personality. So I do kind of feel like Pride has a limited place for people like myself. And like a lot of gays I know who just, they're not going to go out there to a party. I mean, the parade is kind of the closest they can identify, or a great house party with friends. Like those are usually the more casual and enjoyable ways for me to engage in Pride.
Yeah.
So for a long time, I think I felt like, oh, you know, I should do X, you know, according to Pride. And I just realized it's not the only gay context.
Right.
I guess I'll say that,
yeah.
You know, and also I've performed at a ton of Pride festivals. And when it comes down to it, you know, there's really not much more than the scene queen aspect of Pride to most festivals. I wish I could say different, but that's the case.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I went, when I first moved to New York City, I went to the Halloween parade, which was pretty prideful. But then, how do I say this? A guy fell on me dressed, mm-hmm. He was in a very bulky costume, and he fell on me and kind of pinned me to the ground unintentionally, and someone snapped a picture of it, and it wasn't until I looked at the next edition of the Village Voice that I saw myself on the cover being pinned by a guy dressed as a feminine product. And I haven't been back to many parades since.
Oh, but tell the truth. That was not your first time being pinned by a feminine product.
Oh, it's such a good metaphor, except it really happened.
Nap.
Okay, so that's you and ice cream. So many more topics. Now, this one, I don't know if you were kidding or not. And if you were, this will be the disappointment of my week. Okay, so hopefully this is a real thing. I'll ask it more vaguely, and then we'll zero in. Do you have a very notable television personality as your aunt?
Oh, God. In my dreams, she is.
She's not really your aunt?
No, Aunt Eleanor, my Eleanor Clift. Oh, she's my dream aunt. Oh, I love her.
I read a status update, listeners, that Eleanor Clift was Phil Putnam's aunt, and I got so excited. And it was really the reason I had him back on the show. And now it's like, I don't even know what to do with myself. For people who don't know who Eleanor Clift is, which that's problematic, but tell everyone who she is and why she's your dream aunt.
I will say this, first of all, dear listeners, if you know who Eleanor Clift is, email Ken and say, I know who Eleanor Clift is, and I will send you a free unreleased song, because I want to encourage knowledge of Eleanor Clift, okay?
Ken@thisshowisogay.com.
Now, it's on the honor system, you know, so for those of you that lie, Eleanor sees all. But Eleanor Clift is a political commentator, and she's one of the regular guests on McLaughlin Group. And I am pretty certain I am the only 34, soon-to-be 35-year-old in the world that religiously watches McLaughlin Group. But I just love that show. And, you know, that there's two liberals and two Republicans, and then there's John McLaughlin, who's just a vulture, an old vulture.
Wait, he's still alive?
I know. He's amazing. And or maybe it's the alien from Men in Black just inside working him as a puppet. I don't care either way. He's amazing. Eleanor Clift is my spirit animal. I love her. She's just this old liberal battle axe with Velcro shoes and costume jewelry, and she's brilliant. And I think she wrote for Newsweek for years, and then now that Newsweek's out of business, she officially writes for the Daily Beast.
I'm going to try to get her on the show.
Oh, my God, can you please? I will be a caller for that show. I just love her. And my partner and I will sit there and watch McLaughlin Group at 11:30 on a Sunday morning and be the happiest we've ever been.
It's hard for me to think about the McLaughlin Group without thinking about the old school Saturday Night Live sketch about it. And that's why it's amazing to me that that's still on, because that Saturday Night Live sketch was like Dana Carvey. That was maybe 20 years ago.
And, you know, it's funny because I definitely have strong political views. I wouldn't call myself a particularly like political person. Like, I wouldn't say I'm an activist, but I find that show to be so interesting and so intriguing, primarily because of the dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, so I love hearing the opposing viewpoints, and I love seeing whatever buffet of Republican idiots they bring on each year. I never thought I would say this, but after the string of morons they've had on the red side on that show for the past few years, I'm actually missing Monica Crowley.
I wish
they would bring her back, you know, just so we could get some sort of presence on that side of the aisle.
All right. I love that they are always wondering, well, someone's watching it in New York City, and now we know who.
I'm the one.
I love it. Hey, here's a topic we've never talked about on our show. We never talk about selfies, and I learned from your Facebook feed that there are inappropriate places to take a selfie.
Well, okay, here's a short list. In the bathroom with the toilet seat up.
Okay.
That's not good.
No.
Maybe in a store while you're shoplifting. That's always
That's not good. That's not good.
Or maybe at the 9/11 memorial.
Did you snap that picture? I didn't even see her.
I did. So let me give a little context, dear listeners. I went to the 9/11 memorial with my family this past weekend. And it's an intense place.
Yeah.
It's in some ways uplifting, and it was very informational, but it's emotionally trying. So be prepared if you go. And also the plaza in which it sits is pretty large, and there's the two enormous reflecting pool fountains. So there's a lot of time to kind of prepare and get into the space where you're ready to go in and kind of immerse in this experience. And also there's quite a long line at this point in time to get in. So you're already sort of in the mode when you get into line to wait to get your ticket and then go in. And I'm standing there in line with my family, and I look over, and there is this muscle queen idiot who is actually posing, like muscle man posing, and taking selfies of himself in his reflection on the 9/11 memorial building. And it's a very shiny surface, and maybe that's why he was attracted to it. Whatever.
Could be.
And he's taking selfies of himself actually posing, like with Beyonce hip, you know, like in the reflection of the 9/11 memorial. And I normally won't invade somebody's privacy and like take a picture of them and publish it, but this guy completely deserved it. I thought this is the most inappropriate thing I've seen in a long time. And it's like, you know, if you want to take a selfie, that's fine, but there are probably some places that are a little more sacred than your image, and I would probably say that the 9/11 memorial is one of them.
There you go. All right, folks, watch where you're taking your selfies, or don't take them.
Mm-hmm.
Or don't take them. Well, I teased this in your intro, and now we got to get to it. We are debuting a song of yours called Alone No More. I have listened to it several times. We are going to play it in its entirety right after this interview, right at the end of the show. First, tell everyone how you came to write Alone No More.
This is a This Show Is So Gay exclusive.
Yes.
The single will release a little bit later this month. And so you guys are hearing it first. I actually wrote and recorded this record over about a 3-year period, and I finished it last May, so May of 2013. By the time I finished it, I just was not really, frankly, in any mood to release a record, is what it came down to. I love this record, but I know what it means to push that boulder up that hill and release a record on your own independently, primarily through social media, and I wasn't ready for it.
Yeah.
And I believe so much in this record, and I didn't want to give it a half-hearted effort. So I just decided to wait and just let it come naturally, and that's what's happened. So I've always known Alone No More would be the first single from this record, and I decided about 2 weeks ago that I was going to release it. So you guys are coming to this with the first listen after a large chunk of my life, you know, developing this music, and I'm really, frankly, very joyful to share it with you, especially here where there's so much history with this show. It's okay.
Yes. Well, can we talk about a couple of the lines in the song that people will hear in just a few minutes and get your reflection? Love will be found in friendship. Were you writing about me?
Well, Ken, I write everything about you.
Oh, I'm so uncomfortable because it's true.
It's so true.
So love will be found in friendship. That's exciting. But here's the tip, because this is my favorite line in the song. I've listened to it 4 times since you sent it to me. Here is my favorite line in the song. First of all, what do you think my favorite line in the song is?
Is it the one that says soaked in sex?
No, but people will hear that as well. I knew you were going to go there. That's funny. Let's talk off the air about your impressions of me. My favorite line, my favorite 3 words, it's such a lovely phrase, and I want you to tell us all how to do this. How do we harvest the healthy?
Oh, yeah. So, and the larger line there is someone to harvest the healthy, someone to cut out the rest.
Yeah.
And the song really is about, I was looking at various stages of relationship or lack of relationship, is really what this whole record was about. It was sort of the distance between staying and leaving. And if I was going to pinpoint where this song lives, it's really thinking about that moment where after you've been through that heartbreak, that first moment where you really start opening up to the idea again that maybe there could be happiness for you. So this song is really about that initial moment of restoration and that sort of that rebirth of optimism and hope. And that's where the song comes from. And so in terms of harvesting the healthy, it just has to do with my addiction to growth, honestly. And I guess I chose those words not only for alliteration, which I love alliteration, but it's more about, you know, getting healthy and gathering the healthy things in your life is deliberate.
Yeah.
It's not passive. Harvesting is work. It's labor. And it's not always hard, but it's always deliberate. It's always a choice, and it's always active in terms of making it a matter of will. And anybody who's gone through any kind of heartbreak and restoration knows that so much of it is a matter of will.
Yeah.
And so that's what that line is really about.
Love it. Well, what happens next for you, sir?
You know, I'm going to keep releasing singles. That's the next thing for sure. I think also I'm going to keep developing a couple musicals.
Okay.
So that's kind of what's next for me. I'm taking a much more relaxed approach to things. You know, I've been pretty maniacal about music for the past 20 years solid. And this year, you know, since the start of 2014, it's been a much different pace. But I know that I'm going to keep releasing singles until I'm ready to release a new album. And then from there, who knows?
You can also stroll on over, as you well should, to philputnam.com, because there's a lot going on there, including a link to his Facebook page where it's all going down. It's all going down. You're quite the ubiquitous, very present, prolific Facebooker.
I am. And I'll tell you this. This is an inside tip. You can find my music page, and that's totally fine. Please like it. Please be a fan. But I'm much more active on my personal page. So
okay.
Don't be shy. I'm a nice guy. If you want, just send me a friend request. That's really where I post on a regular basis. And then also, I'm crazy into Instagram now. So if you go to Phil Putnam Music, that's my Instagram handle. And that's where I post most stuff from these days.
Nice. Well, I will give you the honor that only a few have had in the 6-year, 300-plus guest history of this show Is So Gay. I'm going to let you do the close of the show. All you need to do, sir, the keywords are going to be so gay, and you will know when to say them. Are you up for it?
I am up for them.
All right. Hey, folks, thank you guys so much for listening. That brings us to the end of this week's episode. Our huge, huge thanks to, of course, Phil Putnam and, of course, to Liana Creel from Saved by the Bell fame. And she's got that amazing movie on YouTube. Go watch it. It's only 9 minutes long. It's called Offside. It's kind of life-changing, and it's really at an appropriate moment right now, given the World Cup and violence in the world. So go watch that. You guys, go get out there. Go do whatever it is that you do to use your voice to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And of course, while you're out there doing it, please remember, why be gay when you can be
so gay?
There's something that I want to hope for, something in which I believe, that we can be found here together, that we can be what we need. And love will be felt in friendship. Love will be soaked in sex. Love will cipher a message we'll never forget. Set it free, let it be different than before. Someone to hold it together through shadows and valleys and death. Companion to carry our memories. Champion to cherish our time. The truth that we existed because they witness our life. Set it free.
Left alone.